Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 131 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Did you know that United Nations Security Council Resolution 131, adopted on December 9th, 1958, examined the application of the Republic of Guinea for membership in the United Nations? Only France abstained. The importance of this will become obvious later. You can email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E, as usual. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. And I do really appreciate your comments, whether by Facebook or by email. Or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.fm, or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Note that you will be responsible for any long-distance charges. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And what that thank you gift is a little bookmark made from some of the photographs that I have taken over the years, hand cut by me, until I get an assistant. If you would like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. And also somebody you can vent on when I say something you don't like. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on science, medicine, viruses, democracy, or various social issues, I'd be happy to discuss possibilities with you. Currently, you could donate via PayPal using david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com or go to infectiousmyth.com/donate.php for more information. Almost nothing in the popular or scientific press questions the assertion that Ebola is a virus that causes a deadly hemorrhagic fever. That fear is understandable given how conservative scientism has become. The fear of being attacked for having a contrary view. That's what science is supposed to be about. But it's now become the opposite of science. But almost nothing published about Ebola supports the assertion that Ebola is a deadly virus either. Instead, almost everything published on Ebola just takes the infectious theory as given and is compatible with the theory being true or being false. So when I heard of a perfect vaccine trial, my ears pricked up. By perfect, I mean a trial that found no, that's zero, cases of Ebola in the vaccinated and a significant number in the unvaccinated. If this trial of the, quote, perfect vaccine was itself perfect, then my belief that the Ebola virus does not exist, that the non-existent virus does not cause hemorrhagic fever, and that the disease itself had completely morphed away from hemorrhagic fever, I would be wrong. On the other hand, if the trial is not perfect but flawed, then the vaccine would not be perfect either. Quite the opposite. The trial is cutely named Ebola Ça Suffit, French for Ebola, that's enough. The full title is Efficacy and Effectiveness of an RVSV Vectored Vaccine in Preventing Ebola Virus Disease, Final Results from the Guinea Ring Vaccination, Open Label Cluster Randomized Trial, and was published online and open access by The Lancet on December 22nd, 2016. I will include a link so you can read it yourself. The vaccine used by the trial is known as RVSV-ZEBOV from Merck. The researchers declare no participation or funding from Merck beyond the provision of the vaccine. And I didn't look into the potential conflicts of interest. I didn't need to based on what I found. I didn't have to look very far before finding problems with this trial. serious problems. To start with, this was not the gold standard of a clinical trial. It was not a placebo-controlled, randomized, double-blind trial because, one, it did not use a placebo, two, was only partially randomized, and three, was not double-blind. Instead of the two arms being placebo and vaccine, they were immediate for a group that received the vaccination right away and deferred a group that was vaccinated after a delay of 21 days. Worse yet, there was also a third group that was not randomized at all, but just given the vaccine right away and observed. A valid scientific trial should have a carefully chosen placebo, an intervention that is indistinguishable in every way from both the researchers and the participants from the active treatment, but that has no known side effects. For example, saline solution instead of the vaccine. This provides the comparison for both effectiveness and adverse effects. This benchmark, this necessary benchmark, did not exist for this trial. Secondly, the trial was not fully randomized. What's supposed to happen in a trial is each individual is, through the selection of a random number, assigned to one arm or the other, to immediate or deferred. But in this trial, every time a case of Ebola was admitted into the trial, all the contacts of this person, this original person is known as the index case, and all the contacts of their contacts were assigned as a group to immediate or deferred. So maybe 10 or 100 people would be assigned based on this one random selection. This means that if there were any important random differences between the two arms, these would be magnified by the inclusion of an entire cluster. For example, if there were more clusters in one group from a particular tribe or town, all the contacts and the contacts of contacts would be more likely to be from the same tribe or town. And as a group, they might have health, dietary, and economic characteristics differing from the average. This problem was not considered by the trial. In fact, the only information gathered on participants was age, gender, and whether the cluster was located in a rural area or an urban area. They didn't collect income level, type of housing, employment status, access to treated water, educational level, or other attributes that could help verify whether there were differences between supposedly randomized groups that could be explained by other factors, such as poverty. Even when a trial uses proper randomization procedures, it is necessary to collect information about the participants to verify that randomization was successful. If you find twice as many women in one group as another, you know something's gone wrong with the randomization, or you were just really unlucky choosing random numbers. That would be an indication that randomization has failed, and the trial would therefore be a failure. This is even more important using partial cluster-by-cluster randomization. If you do analysis of a lot of factors and you find that it's pretty much evenly split between the two arms, then you can say that even though the randomization was not theoretically perfect, it did seem to work in practice. But in this case, they just didn't collect that information. Thirdly, the trial was not blinded, let alone double-blinded, because one group received the shot of vaccine on day one, and the second group was interviewed on day one, but only received a shot on day 21. Double blinding means that neither the participants nor the researchers know who receives which intervention. Both types of blinding are important to eliminate bias, but in this trial, the design made that impossible. Let me explain a little bit. If the participants know whether they got the intervention, the vaccine or the drug, or the placebo, they may try to subconsciously or consciously help the researchers by telling them what they think they want to hear. It's even worse when the researchers know, because the researchers may also have a vested interest, even a financial interest, in the results of the trial. They really want it to work, and so their recording of data may be biased by whether somebody had received the intervention or not. And we'll see later that that could be extremely important in this trial. All of these issues could have been resolved by choosing a better trial design. If individual participants were randomized to receive either the vaccine on day one and placebo 3 weeks later, or placebo on day one and vaccine 3 weeks later, a placebo could have been used, and the trial could have been double-blinded. Each participant could have been randomly assigned a unique numeric code, and nobody would have known what was in vial 1 with a particular code, nor what was in vial 2. You would know that it would be the opposite if vial 1 was vaccine, vial 2 would be placebo, and vice versa, but you wouldn't know which one it was. And that's the way it should be. And there doesn't seem to be any reason why the trial couldn't have been done in this way. This is not simply an academic criticism. It's been known for a long time that non-randomized trials are more likely to find that the intervention is successful than properly randomized trials. And it's also known that trials, even when randomized, that are not double-blinded, are also more likely to find the intervention is beneficial. For example, an article by Kolditz and others in StatMed from 1989 stated that in this study of 128 evaluations reported in journals selected from 4 medical disciplines, half of the investigations used a randomized design. The overall likelihood of success reported from studies of innovations compared to standard therapy was substantially greater for the non-random studies than for the randomized studies. It further says that within the randomized trials, those that did not use a double-blind design reported a significantly greater likelihood of success for innovations on average than those that used double-blinding. So, in other words, if you want your intervention to succeed, which pretty much every drug or vaccine researcher wants, then you should avoid randomization and you should avoid double-blinded. But if you want to get the best science, then you should definitely randomize every person in the trial, and you should definitely use a double-blind design. As I mentioned earlier, there was a third group of 19 clusters, and a cluster is one index patient, one person with Ebola, plus all their contacts, plus contacts of contacts. A third group of 19 clusters was completely unrandomized. A few months into the trial, they apparently decided that the vaccine was perfect, so all new cases of Ebola were assigned to be immediately vaccinated. The inclusion of the data from this third arm is strange, especially as it has important differences from the other two arms, such as an average age of the index case of more than 10 years younger, due to the late inclusion of children in the trial, and a much lower fraction of the clusters living in rural areas. The existence of this non-randomized arm gave the researchers some flexibility that they should not have had. If they liked the results from this group, they could include it, and if they didn't, they could easily justify its exclusion. Since this arm received immediate vaccination and they did not find any Ebola cases in those vaccinated in this group within certain parameters, it was obviously beneficial to their case to include it, and it would increase the level of statistical significance that they could report. In any trial of an intervention, there will be a significant number of people who are excluded from the trial, who decline to participate, or who simply fail to show up when it's time to receive the pill or to be injected with a vaccine or whatever. It's important that the different treatment arms do not differ too much in the reasons to fail to complete the trial. Of the 9,096 people in the 98 randomized clusters, 49.9% were assigned to the immediate group and 50.1% of the people to the deferred group. There were, however, 51 clusters in the immediate group versus 47 in the deferred group, which is a much bigger difference. And this indicates that when they were doing the randomization, they were trying to keep the number of individuals the same in both arms, which is actually further reducing the level of true randomization. In a randomized trial, or a trial that's claimed to be randomized, just about any characteristic of the two or more randomized arms that is measured before the intervention is initiated should be approximately the same. So, for example, you should have approximately the same number, same percentage of women in both arms. If you measure people who got a high school education versus those who got more, it should be approximately the same percentage in both arms. There will be slight deviations due to the use of random numbers. It will never be perfect. So it's a good sign that the fraction of individuals who were ruled eligible to participate in the trial in the two randomized arms was similar, 71% in the immediate group and 68% of the deferred group. Probably can explain the difference by random variation. Similarly, of those who were eligible, about 66% were vaccinated in both the immediate and the deferred arm of the trial. However, due to the strange design of this trial, the inside of this sausage was remarkably different. I'm not sure we want to look at it. In the immediate arm, participants were asked only once whether they wanted to be vaccinated. 2,151 out of 3,232 agreed, that's 67%, and then they were immediately vaccinated on the same day. The remainder either refused consent or didn't show up to the appointment. That's 67% of the immediate arm agreed on day, what they call day zero, and were vaccinated on day zero. But in the deferred arm, only 1,435 out of 3,096 consented on the first day. That's 46%. The reason why the final total was similar was because in this arm, they were given a second chance to consent, and quite a few eventually agreed. On the other hand, a significant number who had consented on day zero decided to refuse or did not show up 21 days later on their vaccination day. This could mean that although a similar fraction of both groups was vaccinated, that the groups might be quite different in composition because of the way they were selected by two different methods. One had a single shot at agree or disagree, the other had two shots. The researchers not only did not collect much data about people in the two arms overall, but they presented no data to compare those who were vaccinated in the immediate arm versus those who were vaccinated in the deferred arm. So we have no way to know whether those who were vaccinated in the immediate group are comparable to those vaccinated in the deferred group. Were they younger or older, more rural or more urban, sicker or healthier, wealthier or poorer, better or less educated? We do not know. Regarding safety, the trial found a very high rate of minor adverse effects and some serious adverse effects, including a number of deaths. They did not comment on whether the minor issues were related to the vaccine, but since the list was headed by headache, 25% of adults, but 54.7% of children, fatigue and muscle pain, fatigue at 19%, muscle pain at 14%, they probably were related to the vaccine, and without a proper control group, it's impossible to eliminate this possibility. In adults, some adverse effects persisted for over 4 days, such as headache in 27% of the adults, fatigue in 17%, and joint pain in 12%. Remember these side effects. They will be important later. There were 80 adverse effects classified by the researchers as serious, of which the researchers declared only two were definitely related to the vaccination, one serious fever and one serious allergic reaction, and one possibly related to vaccination influenza-like symptoms. This is almost universal in a trial without a control that adverse effects will be discovered, and the only way to decide whether they're related to the intervention or not is by the choice of a physician. Now, why would a physician who wants the trial to succeed declare that all 80 serious adverse effects were related to the vaccine? It's much easier to say, well, we can't be sure, so we'll throw it out. The precautionary principle should be that all 80 should be included unless you have a placebo, a proper comparison group, to help eliminate them. So, for example, if you had 80 serious adverse effects in the vaccinated group and you had 10 in the unvaccinated group, you could guess that around 70, a statistical guess, you could guess that around 70 of them are actually real adverse effects related to the vaccine, and 10 of them would have happened anyway. Of course, you don't know which 10, but you have some idea of the rate of serious adverse effects. But in this case, just the prejudice of the researchers is, no, they're not related to the vaccine. Some, I agree, were clearly not related to the vaccine. For example, they occurred in unvaccinated people, and there was, for example, a fatal traffic accident. Even if that person had been vaccinated, it's unlikely that it was related to the vaccine. But there were also other serious adverse effects that were thrown out, such as malaria. It's not clear whether this was properly diagnosed or was just a serious fever, heart attack, spontaneous abortion, bone fracture, and an infected wound. The researchers might not think that these adverse effects are plausibly related to a vaccine, But it's also not impossible for a vaccine to mimic the symptoms of malaria, to cause a heart attack, to cause an abortion, to weaken bones, or weaken the immune system. Without a blinded placebo, a proper comparison group, it's really impossible to say. And forgive me if throughout talking about this paper, I keep hammering away that there was no proper comparison group. The purpose of a clinical trial is to find surprising correlations, not to assume that there will be no surprises. You can't assume that a vaccine won't cause spontaneous abortions. You have to prove it. And just waving your hands and saying, well, since we don't have a control group, I'm going to rule that the spontaneous abortion was not related, and that the weakness of the immune system, whatever that really means, was not related, and the extremely high fever that we diagnosed as malaria was not related to the vaccine. There's really no way to say whether the scientists are right or not. And they do have a conscious and unconscious bias of wanting the trial to work. The most common serious adverse event was Ebola, which you might find a bit strange to call it an adverse event, but basically in a clinical trial, anything bad that happens after you give an intervention is considered an adverse effect. Adverse event, not an adverse effect. Adverse event, because we don't know if it's related to the vaccine. And so it's probably logical to you to assume that the vaccine couldn't actually cause Ebola. It's a vaccine against Ebola, so how could it cause it? Some cases diagnosed as Ebola did occur in vaccinated people, even though I mentioned earlier that this was a perfect vaccine trial in which no cases of Ebola occurred in those vaccinated. Actually, some did, but the researchers decided that cases of Ebola that occurred within the first 10 days after vaccination would be excluded due to their beliefs about the incubation period of the virus and the time needed for the vaccine to stimulate the immune system. If, for example, Ebola has a 30-day incubation period, if you are vaccinated on day zero and you get Ebola on day five, it couldn't actually be caused, have anything to do with the vaccine, because it must have occurred 25 days before. That's the theory. I'll discuss later why that's probably not true. Cases, as I said, did occur among the vaccinated, but all within the first 10 days. How did the cases of Ebola in the first 10 days among the vaccinated compared with those who received a placebo? Right, there was no placebo, so there was no reasonable comparison. Assumptions about the virus and the vaccine cannot substitute for the stronger evidence that a placebo can provide. Additionally, what is the probability that someone would be diagnosed with Ebola coincidentally within a few days of receiving a vaccine? The researchers report that in Guinea, a country of 10.5 million people, there were 476 cases of Ebola during the trial period, an average of about 1.6 per day over the entire country, 10.5 million people. People were chosen for this trial because of contact with someone diagnosed with Ebola, or in most cases, contact with someone who had contact with someone diagnosed with Ebola. So their risk of Ebola would be expected to be higher than average if you buy the infectious theory. However, it's still, given the tiny number of Ebola cases, a statistical impossibility, i.e. highly improbable, that someone would be diagnosed with Ebola within a few days of vaccination. Well, it might seem impossible, but in this trial, there were 25 cases of Ebola among the vaccinated within the 10 days following vaccination, and 6 were diagnosed on the day of vaccination, 3 the following day, and 7 the day afterwards. Is it crazy to claim that the vaccine can trigger Ebola? Well, maybe yes, maybe no, but I don't think talking about it is crazy, and we'll get into that later. You're going to need a little bit more information before we can actually process what sounds like a crazy idea at this point. Okay, so the success of the trial, it was reported as nobody vaccinated got Ebola. Well, we know that's not exactly true because some people were diagnosed with Ebola within the first 10 days, but let's give them that for now. It might sound amazing that the study found no cases of Ebola among the vaccinated during the observation period. But we already know that cases within the first 10 days were not counted against the vaccine, and the observation period only lasted a further 21 days. But no matter how amazing this sounds in a newspaper article, the comparative success of the vaccine will not be accepted as valid by other scientists unless it is statistically significant. And in this trial, the scientists appear to be trying to play some statistical games to make the difference highly statistically significant due to the low number of Ebola cases being diagnosed at that time and due to the lack of a proper control group. I guess we could say that without a proper control group, they had to play statistical games to get any numbers at all. Their best analysis showed zero cases of Ebola in the immediately vaccinated group versus 34 in the other group with a statistical p-value of 0.0012. This means that the chances that this difference is not real is well under 1%. But what was this other group? Well, for some reason, they lumped together the entire delayed group, vaccinated and unvaccinated, as well as all the unvaccinated people in the immediate group, but not the vaccinated, obviously, and for good measure, the unvaccinated people in the non-randomized group, but not the vaccinated people. The only reason that I can think of for doing this is to generate an amazing p-value. It's almost like they sat around with their computers and they added and subtracted groups until they got the best p-value, and they said, okay, we'll publish this one. Clearly, a group of people who've been vaccinated, who've been ruled eligible and who've consented to vaccination doesn't compare to a dog's breakfast of people who've been vaccinated or not, and for some people who haven't even been randomized. Other analyses in the paper generated much less impressive p-values, and scientists are way too excited about p-values anyway, but they all have one thing in common. They are not comparing groups that differ only in whether the person was vaccinated. Given that the people who are not vaccinated were either ruled ineligible for vaccination or chose not to be vaccinated, they do not represent a valid comparison with people who had all been ruled eligible and who had all consented. At the risk of repeating myself, I have to emphasize that there was no proper comparison with the vaccinated group in this trial. The overly clever and complex trial design means that it's impossible to make a statistically valid statement about the results. And given that there are an almost infinite number of invalid comparisons they could make, the researchers could pick and choose until they got the one that generated the most impressive statistical results. The only real claim they can make is that no vaccinated person came down with Ebola between 10 and 31 days after vaccination. But some did come down with Ebola during the first 10 days, which they arbitrarily decided was not the fault of the vaccine, and they stopped monitoring after 31 days. So how impressive is this, really? What if the vaccine just delayed the incubation period of Ebola to, say, 60 days? So if you'd followed these people for another few months, you might have diagnosed a bunch of Ebola cases in the vaccinated. But they stopped measuring after a very short time. Further statistical machinations relate to what they call the attack rate. This is simply the percentage of a group of people who get Ebola during a time period. And there are two significant problems with what they did here. First of all, there are two time periods that vary significantly in length, and the attack rate is not justified, adjusted for time. The first period is the 10 days after vaccination, during which any case of Ebola is not blamed on the vaccine, and then there is the 21-day observation period used to determine the effectiveness of the vaccine. You'll note that 21 days is a little bit more than double 10 days. For the non-vaccinated people in the immediate group, the attack rate in the first 10 days was 0.8%, and in the following 21 was 0.6%. Those numbers sound similar, but if we change it to the attack rate per day, which is more meaningful, then the rate in the first 10 days was 0.08% per day, 0.1%, and in the next 21 days was only 0.03%, less than half. Similarly, for the deferred group, the published attack rates are 0.7% for the first 10 days and 0.5% for the next 21. It's pretty similar. But adjusted, those are 0.07% and 0.02%, more than a 3 times difference. Why would the risk of Ebola differ by a factor of 2 or 3 in the unvaccinated between the first 10 and the next 21 days? If you argue that the attack rates are meaningless because the number of cases was so small and that this is just random variation, then you cannot claim that the trial was effective based on the attack rate of 0 in the immediate group among the vaccinated. The second problem is that the attack rate for the whole delayed group was not broken down into vaccinated and unvaccinated, unlike the immediate group. The only plausible reason for this that I can think of is that the researchers were trying to hide something that would not support their case. If the attack rate of the combined immediate group that's both vaccinated and unvaccinated is compared against the delayed group for the first 10 days, the attack rates are similar, 0.06% per day for immediate and 0.07% per day for deferred. But for the next 20 days, they are surprisingly different, 0.01% versus 0.025%. Why would people in the group with delayed vaccination have more than triple the risk of getting Ebola 10 to 31 days after vaccination? So let's move on to the diagnosis. And we're starting to get into actually more serious problems, just in case you didn't think, just in case you thought the problems we've already discussed are serious, we'll get into more serious problems now. A problem with a so-called open label trial, which these researchers openly described their trial as open label, is bias in the diagnosis of the endpoint. Open label means that you know what intervention you're giving to a patient. In some cases, if it's blinded, the patient might not know, but the researchers do. In this case, the researchers and the participants knew. This was because you either got the vaccine right away, or you got a talk and a request to sign a piece of paper on day zero, and then 21 days later, you had another chance to decide whether to participate, and you got injected. So everybody knew whether you were in the trial or not. So how does this influence the diagnosis of Ebola? Since the researchers knew what condition the intervention is supposed to prevent, if there were marginal cases, it would be easy to diagnose it preferentially in people who did not receive the intervention, the vaccine, and to not diagnose it in the marginal cases in people that did. This could be largely subconscious, driven by the desire to see the trial be successful, although scientifically, a trial that shows an intervention is ineffective or dangerous is also successful if you think about it. And this is known as detection bias. But how can there be bias in the diagnosis of a hemorrhagic fever? The symptoms are so bloody obvious. Apologies for the joke. Well, Ebola, it will probably surprise you to find out, is no longer a hemorrhagic fever. The symptoms now are radically different from when Ebola was claimed to have been discovered in the 1970s. I used the CDC's 2014 definition, which is still on their website, which has two components to a suspect Ebola case. Elevated body temperature or subjective fever or symptoms including severe headache, fatigue, muscle pain, vomiting, diarrhea, abdominal pain, or unexplained hemorrhage. So you need one of those symptoms, and note that only the last of those symptoms has anything to do with bleeding. Secondly, you need an epidemiological risk factor, e.g. contact with a person with Ebola or their bodily fluids within the 21 days before the onset of symptoms. So this is a common addition to a disease definition. This was also found in the SARS definition. And this helps create the illusion that a disease is infectious. If you can only diagnose it in people who've been in contact with other people with the disease, you don't risk diagnosing people who've never had contact with anybody with Ebola, never been to anywhere where there's Ebola. All of a sudden, they're getting diagnosed with Ebola, and it's popping up in Antarctica and Dallas and London, England, and places, and people who've never traveled or never had neighbors who were in any of these countries. So the epidemiological part of the definition is very important at making it seem like the disease is being transmitted in an infectious manner. Note that only one of the first list of symptoms is required, and many people in this trial, due to the nature of the trial, would have had the second risk factor. So you were enrolled in the trial if you were a contact of a person with Ebola or a contact of a contact. Every symptom of Ebola that is listed, except the last two, were also listed as minor side effects that occurred shortly after vaccination with the Ebola vaccine. In fact, of the 10 minor post-vaccination symptoms found in the trial, only two are not in the definition of Ebola, which are a joint pain and something called induration, which is hardening of the skin around the injection site. And there was only one case out of several thousand people in the trial. So really, only joint pain was found after vaccination, which is not included on the list of Ebola symptoms. But the CDC implies that other symptoms could also diagnose Ebola, because they, if you read it carefully, it's very sloppy English, but if you read it carefully, it says, elevated body temperature or subjective fever or symptoms, comma, including, and then a list. So when you start a list with symptoms including the following, it kind of implies that you could have other things that could also result in the diagnosis if you wanted it to. So maybe joint pain could. Now, a confirmed case of Ebola must also have a positive laboratory test, which is either based on antibodies or genes, known as PCR or viral load, or cell culture, which sometimes is called isolation, even though it's not. The CDC provides no algorithm for deciding how many tests to perform, nor any assistance on how to interpret conflicting results. Note that in the case of HIV, there are many algorithms for diagnosing HIV. You might, for example, take a single antibody test known as ELISA, and if it's positive, you then do two more ELISA tests. And if at least one of those is positive, you will then do a Western blot. That's only one algorithm. And one of the problems with HIV is there's so many algorithms that you clearly could see some people being diagnosed with HIV and others not. But it's even worse in this case where you just say, do an Ebola test. So we've come a long way from the 1970s. In the 1970s, what was called Ebola was a clinical disease, and it was very distinct in a most horrible way. People would arrive at a clinic with blood coming from every orifice in their body, their mouth, their anus, their eye sockets. But now the symptoms are so vague as to be completely indistinguishable from the flu, except for the lab test, which would almost certainly not be done if you thought you were in the midst of a flu epidemic or some other infectious epidemic rather than an Ebola epidemic. Symptoms are actually rarely reported in the literature for Ebola anymore, but when they are, hemorrhagic symptoms are unusual amongst diagnosed Ebola cases. For example, a paper published in 2014 in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine by Schifflin and others, entitled Clinical Illness and Outcomes in Patients with Ebola in Sierra Leone, found that, quote, only one out of 106 patients in our study cohort had overt bleeding at presentation. That's upon arrival at the hospital. Although bleeding has been noted in previous outbreaks, our results show that this symptom is rare in the current outbreak. And there's no reason to believe that it's any different based on the current CDC definition of Ebola or on what was written in this trial. There was no mention of hemorrhagic symptoms in this trial. There was no list of what the symptoms of Ebola were, if any. Given this definition with its generic symptoms, if you want to make a case of Ebola go away, say a person with a sudden fever, you could claim that their symptoms are not severe enough, or that they began before the 10-day mark, or you could interpret ambiguous lab results as negative. And if you would like to create a case of Ebola, say in a person who is not being vaccinated, you would do the opposite. And this would not even have to be a conscious desire. Because the trial was not blinded, there's lots of room for subconscious wish fulfillment. And this is not just my imagination. This is the reason why medical science invented the double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled clinical trial. But we need to return to the issue of whether the vaccine could itself, ironic quotes, cause Ebola. I use the ironic quotes because, of course, Ebola is defined as a viral disease. The question is really, can the vaccine cause the symptoms of Ebola and a positive Ebola test, which is required for a confirmed Ebola case? Well, obviously, the symptoms of Ebola are highly compatible with a variety of common adverse events such as fever, headache, fatigue, and muscle pain. In fact, as I pointed out, most of the symptoms of Ebola are most of the symptoms the minor symptoms that occurred shortly after vaccination. But what about the positive test result needed for a confirmed diagnosis? That seems impossible. Well, not so quick. It's not as difficult as it sounds, because when surveys have been done of healthy people, a surprising fraction test positive for Ebola. A 2010 article in the open access journal PLOS 1, the Public Library of Science 1, by Beckhart and others, high prevalence of both humoral and cellular immunity to Zaire Ebola virus among rural populations in Gabon, showed that an average of 15.3% and almost 20% of people in the area tested were Ebola positive. Yet, this was in an area of Gabon without any Ebola cases, and it was in healthy people. So these are clearly false positives. Either that, or Ebola is not the deadly disease that it's made out to be, and that in the majority of people, the vast majority of people, it does no harm. Imagine if, say, 10% of the 10.5 million people in Guinea were carriers of Ebola. That would be a million people. So how could you possibly eliminate Ebola in that case? And why would you be talking about it as a deadly disease when a few thousand people get sick and a million people are perfectly healthy or reasonably healthy with the virus in their body? So it's much more likely that these just represent false positive test results. So if a random person with a fever is tested for Ebola, there could be a very good chance they would test positive. And the chance of being tested for Ebola might be highest when participating in an Ebola vaccine trial, when Ebola transmission is being looked at. And the choice of whether to test somebody for Ebola or not, it might subconsciously be based on, is this person vaccinated or not? If you believe the vaccine works, you might look at them and say, oh, they got a headache and a fever, but I don't think it's Ebola, and you just don't do the test. There was no indication that there was any rigidity to the diagnosis. A clinician says, this is a headache, this is Ebola. That's all it takes. The most shocking thing about this trial, I saved the best for last, is the number of cases. This trial appears to be numerically simply too good to be true. Too many cases of Ebola. The authors admitted that Ebola was declining in Guinea during the trial and that they had largely missed the window of opportunity. I wondered if their writing on this point sounded a little bit wistful, that they really wanted to start the trial in the middle of this deadly epidemic. But of course, by the time they got the funding and they got things organized, it was a little bit late. 4 months after the trial started, they stopped randomizing clusters, although the monitoring went on for several more months, because of the, quote, declining number of cases of Ebola virus disease in the country. Furthermore, they missed enrolling 281 out of 476 Ebola cases, more than 50%, because, again, quote, these 281 cases of Ebola virus disease mostly arose during March and April 2015 during the pilot phase of this trial, and when most study teams were still being trained and the study did not have full capacity. So they let a bunch of cases go by, 281. By August of 2016, about halfway through the trial, again based on a graph that they provided, the number of new Ebola cases being diagnosed in Guinea by the health authorities was down to a handful each month, sometimes a zero. So there had already been a dramatic drop in the number of cases. So let's do a little bit of arithmetic. The 105 cases of Ebola that were found in this trial, that were found at any time during this trial, seemed to be an impossibility. For one thing, if we include all 476 cases of Ebola in Guinea from March 23rd, 2015 through January 20th, 2016, we have an average of 1.6 cases per day in a country of 10.5 million people. Yet in a trial of 11,835 people in all the different arms, 105 cases were found over a slightly shorter period of time because we can basically eliminate March and April. How could this be that they found 105? They found almost a quarter of the cases in their 11,000 people versus the 10.5 million in the entire country. And yes, these people were either exposed to somebody with Ebola or they're exposed to somebody who was exposed to somebody with Ebola, but still, this seems remarkable. But it's worse than that. Out of the 476 cases during the trial period, the study agrees that 281 occurred and were lost because the trial wasn't ready to accept them. So that leaves 195 cases, out of which 117 were used as index cases in the study. There were 117 clusters. Each cluster had one case of Ebola to kick it off. That leaves 78, but there were another 73 cases of Ebola that were excluded because they were already in a cluster. So in other words, if you find a person who's got Ebola and you create a cluster and then you discover that their next-door neighbor has also been diagnosed with Ebola, you can't include the next-door neighbor in the study because you'd basically include the same cluster twice or a huge overlap. So if you do the math, that only leaves 5 cases of Ebola. And the study claims to have found 105. It's obviously a mathematical impossibility. A fly in the ointment is that there were 580 people included from Sierra Leone. But this really wasn't very many. It's only about 5% of the total. And they were only included in the non-randomized arm of the trial. Surely if the majority of the 105 cases had been in the Sierra Leone participants, this would have been mentioned. It would have been stunning if there were 105 cases of Ebola in people from Sierra Leone and no cases in anybody else. But this was not possible because there were only 48 Ebola cases in the non-randomized arm. So still more than half could not be explained by the presence of people from Sierra Leone. One possible explanation is that the study did their own diagnosis of Ebola. In other words, based on symptoms that could equally have been Ebola or a vaccine side effect, headache, fever, fatigue, muscle pain, they decided whether to give an Ebola blood test. That would certainly have been logistically possible, given that they had regular visits scheduled with the vaccinated people, and therefore they had access to the clusters, since a cluster included all family members, next-door neighbors, and so on. Their subconscious bias might rule a headache in an unvaccinated person as serious and warranting an Ebola test, while a similar headache in a vaccinated person might just be listed as a headache. Sometimes a headache is just a headache. But if this was the case, they were diagnosing Ebola cases while the Guinea government was claiming that they had almost eradicated the epidemic. There might be as many as 105 cases of Ebola that this trial did not report to the government. Now, if you believe in Ebola, that's a huge ethical problem. They're covering up a government that says Ebola is disappearing, and they're finding out that it's not disappearing. They're finding all of these cases, and they didn't tell the government. Those 105 cases should have been added to the government's total if they weren't already detected by the government, which, based on numbers, they couldn't have been. So another thing is that given the unreliability of the Ebola test, it would have made sense to have given every participant in the trial an Ebola test at the beginning. There's no indication that they did that. In fact, it probably would have been impossible because anybody testing positive for Ebola at the beginning of the trial would have had to be eliminated. You couldn't include them in a vaccine trial because if they have no symptoms and they're positive for Ebola, it's either a false positive, they're immune to Ebola. So how could you include them in a vaccine trial? But nobody was eliminated on this basis. There were 73 cases of Ebola that were eliminated, but these were cases, as I mentioned earlier, that were more than one person in a cluster. They were not discovered on the basis of the researchers' testing. Without a baseline Ebola test, and given the known flaws in the Ebola testing procedures, as I mentioned from one paper, and there's a number of papers that show similar things with Ebola tests, it's impossible to say that if somebody tested positive during the trial that it was actually an Ebola infection. With a baseline Ebola test, they would have had more accuracy, although false positives aren't always present all the time. It could be that somebody got a condition that caused a false positive Ebola test during the trial, but it would at least have been a lot stronger than what they did. So, in conclusion, Ebola, ça suffit, is a strangely designed Ebola vaccine trial with no placebo. It's only partly randomized, and it's not blinded. There's evidence of statistical manipulation to produce a desirable result, the desirable result being that Merck has invented a perfect vaccine. Strangest of all, the trial's total number of Ebola cases appear to be more than could possibly have occurred in Guinea during that time period when the epidemic was rapidly waning. So this is not a perfect vaccine after all, just a highly imperfect clinical trial producing an impressive but ultimately meaningless result. So a summary of the problems, just to review everything. Without a placebo, there's no meaningful comparison group. You should be able to compare not immediate vaccination with deferred vaccination, but this person was vaccinated, this person got the placebo. And if you think it's unethical to not give the vaccine to half the people, then you could vaccinate half of them on day one, placebo to half of them on day one. Day 21, you give the vaccinated people placebo and you give the placebo people vaccine, and then everybody gets the vaccine and you actually have data that you can work with. The trial was not fully randomized. It was not double-blinded. It was not blinded at all. Both the researchers and participants knew which arm they were in. There was insufficient collection of participant characteristics before the intervention occurred. So there was only basically age, gender, and whether they lived in a rural or urban area. All the other possible things that you could collect were not included. There was no information on the distribution of these characteristics, the limited number of characteristics they collected. There was no information on the distribution between the vaccinated groups. The numbers were provided for the entire group, including people who were ruled ineligible and people who did not consent to be vaccinated or who did not show up or who something happened that prevented them from being vaccinated. There was an inclusion of non-randomized participants in the analysis. There was no ability to determine what proportion of side effects were due to the vaccine due to the lack of a control group. There's a huge overlap between potential vaccine side effects and the definition of Ebola. As I mentioned, there's only two vaccine minor side effects that are not in the definition of Ebola, and there's only two items in the definition of Ebola that are not vaccine side effects or minor side effects detected in the study. There's potential diagnostic bias due to the lack of blinding. If you're a clinician whose judgment is going to be used to determine whether somebody has a fever or Ebola, and if you know that that person was vaccinated or not vaccinated, subconsciously or consciously, you might change your diagnosis. And then there's a numerically impossible number of Ebola diagnoses. And there's really two possibilities here. It could either be outright fraud, which I think is probably unlikely, or more likely is that they basically gave Ebola tests to people when they thought there might be a case of Ebola, but they did not report those to the government, which would be a huge ethical lapse. So I hope you've found this discussion of what is an enormously important paper, scientific paper. I hope you found it interesting, and maybe it will help you in analysis of scientific papers in the future. I would definitely like your responses to this. If you read this paper and you have other issues with the paper, please let me know. If you think my analysis is flawed in some way, I would also like to know that. But at the end of all of this, my belief, based on a lot of reading about Ebola, that the Ebola disease is not caused by a virus, that it's not an infectious disease, that what Ebola is in terms of clinical symptoms has morphed completely since the 1970s up to the present. The views I held at the beginning of reading this paper were a little bit shaken by reading the paper, but once I understood how flawed the paper was, I continue to assert that this whole Ebola epidemic is not a hoax, but it is a self-delusion by people who can only believe an infectious disease. If they go to Africa, they don't think about pollution. They don't think about poor living conditions. They don't think about vitamin deficiencies. They think, what virus is it this time? And that leads to tremendous disasters, such as the whole Ebola epidemic. What if Ebola symptoms were caused by poverty and poor living conditions and pollution and possibly careless use of pesticides and pharmaceuticals? What difference would it be if people went to Africa and tried to help people avoid these toxins that a lot of people might not be aware of? They could actually save lives if they did that. Speaking of vaccines, in Saskatchewan, which is the province next door to Alberta, where I live, there was a whooping cough outbreak in the Five Hills health region. The local health authority said that there were 4 confirmed cases amongst school-aged children. This is a couple of things. First of all, an epidemic these days is anything over 1 case of anything considered to be an infectious illness. But Chief Medical Health Officer Dr. Mark Voot said all 4 have been immunized. And to him, it means that in some people, the vaccine may not give total protection. A person could be asymptomatic, not have any symptoms, and still pass it on to other people. Whether it's influenza or pertussis, this can happen. So what he's basically saying is there's 3 classes of people. There are those who get a vaccine and are protected and not infectious. There are those who get the vaccine, are protected in the sense they don't have symptoms but can still pass it on to other people. And then there are people who get the vaccine and get sick. But when you think about it, they probably don't really know that the so-called asymptomatic people exist. They've probably done no testing for this. It's just a way of explaining something that otherwise would be unexplainable. Another virus, herpes, an article in Stat News in January 26th, 2017, notes the significant possibility of a false positive herpes test. This can destroy people's lives, or at least their sexual lives, because it's believed to be a sexually transmitted virus. One of the things they said in this article was very interesting to me. 1 in 6 people aged 14 to 49 in the United States have the herpes simplex virus 2, and this number goes up with age. Most of these people, however, don't have obvious symptoms and wouldn't know they were carriers without blood tests. So in other words, it's a virus that doesn't cause disease in the vast majority of people. But if somebody has symptoms that are at all compatible with herpes, it's definitely blamed on herpes, although it actually would never be possible to tell without a lot more sophisticated testing. Thank you for listening to episode 131 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, a question, or a suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter @InfectiousMyth. Until next week, goodbye.